Poland suffered a lot in both wars. He escaped with his parents to previous Soviet Union to get away from the Germans. He joined the exile army and was wounded in Balticum. He managed to join the army again and was partially participating in the battles of Berlin 1945. His military career was in the front of him. However, his Jewish background made a shocking stop for that. At the age of 28, he was not any longer a high-ranked officer. The actual reason was some questions his father had with the Israeli embassy. Pierre Bjørn Forås writes in the introduction of the newly written book for the Norwegian public, Savnet Fellesskap. Now he was excluded from the good company and he had to use what was so characteristic of him, an extremely good ability to change, not through pragmatic and outer, more superficial changes, but through a thorough inner transformation. Sigmund Bauman studied sociology, and already in 1954 was he a teacher at the University of Warsaw. During the 1960s, he was the head of Department of Sociology in Warsaw. In 1968, he left the Communist Party and the regime answered by suspending him from the position as a professor of sociology in Warsaw. And he left Poland for Israel the same year. In 1971, he became a professor at Leeds University. And all the publications we know from him is from this period. I will just mention a few. In 1973 came Culture as Praxis. In 1976 came Towards a Critical Sociology. In 1982 came Memories of Class. In 88, Freedom. In 89, Modernity and the Holocaust. In 91, Modernity and Ambivalence. In 92, Mortality, Immortality and Other Life Strategies. In 93 came Postmodern Ethics. In 98, Globalization. In 98, another one, Work, Consumerism and the New Poor. And in 2001, I just mentioned the Bauman Reader. Nearly every year, a new book, at least one new book. The books are translated into many languages, also the Scandinavian languages. In Kaplan's Upopulære Skrifter, Unpopular Writings, just came out a new book, especially written for this publisher, and it is called Savnet Fellesskap. Bauman is a well-known lecturer throughout the world. There are not many weeks he is not traveling around the world and giving lectures to different places. And now we are grateful to have Sigmund Bauman here at the Oslo University College. Thank you.
Liquid modernity, it's the title. Liquid modernity, liquidized modernity, fluid modernity, flowing modernity. If you look into encyclopedia under fluid, you will find out that their most distinguishing feature is that they can't hold shape very well. All sorts of forces acting on them bring immediately a change of shape. Well, having said that, I did a short pause because it goes without saying that I consider it a privilege to be with you today, and I am very pleased and grateful to Irena Levy for inviting me here, for bringing me here, But that's not the point. The real point is whether you will be pleased and grateful to Irena for bringing me here. And I'm afraid that after what I said just now about modernity, you start thinking what for she did bring me far away from Leeds to Oslo in order to tell you just such a banal and trivial truth. Is not that known to every little child, that everything is in change, everything is changing shape from one day to another, that nothing lasts very long around, and so on and so on. Mind you, it was more than 100 years ago when two very, very young Germans from Rhineland, they were the age of you, the student part of the audience, when they did it, they looked around with glittering eyes full of admiration and awe and enthusiasm and wrote down everything solid melted into air, everything sacred is profaned. The name of these very young, enthusiastic people were Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, and the book in which they wrote it was called Communist Manifesto. So if this is news, they are very, very dusty news, if I tell you that modernity is liquid. It has been said more than 150 years ago, and our news, as we are trained in our kind of society, with our newspapers competing for sensation, our news get old in 2 or 3 days, not 150 years. So what is new about, how can I justify my being here? What is new about it? What has changed in comparison with what has been noted already 150 years ago? Well, these young people, Marx and Engels, when they said everything solid had been melted into air and so on and so on, they immediately settled down to design a picture of a perfect society which will be so perfect that any change in the society will be a change to the worse, and therefore it won't need any more change. Let us use our freedom. That was the spirit of the age. Let us use our freedom to free people from the sufferings which free choice inevitably brings. So that can, if we design society in a rational, reasonable way, with every detail, then people will be much happier than they are. What began at that time, when they wrote it, not necessarily under their influence, it was they were just reflecting spirit of their age. What was happening then was a concentrated, ongoing effort to melt the solids, as they put it, but not in order to live among the molten metal, not because of hatred of things solid and stable and reliable, but because the solids which were found, which were extant, which were inherited from what de Tocqueville called Ancien Régime, they were not in a very good condition. They were, first of all, in considerable state of putrefaction. They were already falling apart. And then they were considered to be not very well made in the first place. So melting solids in order to cast new solids, which will be much better molded and which will be much more reliable, much more stable, long-living, durable than the solids of yesterday. Modernity began as a great quest for order, for rational order, order in which things which were set in motion will be halted again, so that people can know in what sort of life they live. And it was not entirely unsuccessful, mind you. I will give you an example from my own biography. I'm not a good biographer, Irena is much better, but I remember distinctly one case which shows some light on what we are talking about today. When I was a student, it was half a century ago, mind you, my teachers of social psychology taught me human psychology on the ground of the experiments made with rats. There were famous million and dollar experiments, but there were plenty of them around, and all experiments were similar. There was a maze or labyrinth built of very tough, impenetrable walls, which were always put in the same place. There were passages between the walls. There were crossroads, you know, when the wall ended. There were turns on these crossroads. Most of the turns were wrong. If you went there, you get nowhere. One was the right one. If you selected the right turns, then in the end there was reward. A very tasty piece, a pellet of food, you know, a piece of pork waiting for the successful rats. And since walls were immovable and the pellet of food was always in the same place, rats, which are very intelligent creatures, could learn. And they did learn, and you can actually sit in the laboratory and measure the speed of their learning, how soon they find the right way, and from then on, they never make mistakes, they always get straight to the food, and they stop being hungry. Now, when I look back, you know, half a century later, I think why we didn't rebel, why there was no student protest, why there was no uprising of some sort or another. Was it because we were animal lovers and we identified ourselves with the rats? I don't think so. Animal loving was not yet in fashion, so we probably didn't feel it very strongly. But I think the reason was different. The reason was different. We really recognize in these experiments with rats reflection of our own condition. That was our life task, you know. World is tough. There are tough walls. They are impenetrable, but they are always in the same place. And once you learn where they are, and once you learn which turns are right, you can be pretty sure that you will be successful. You will never go hungry again. Right? Pellet of food will be always there, whatever reward it might be. That was our image of the world, and that is why we accepted that experiments with rats in labyrinths are telling us something important about the truth of human condition. Now, I don't think that the change of curriculum in social psychology was entirely caused by change of fashion. There was something more than that. Simply, I don't think that very many people would find reflection of their life task or their life prospect in the condition of rats in the labyrinth, simply because the walls today happen to be very often on wheels. They move, they change places, and the pellet of food changes places very quickly, and the food gets stale before you get it, so it's not attractive anymore, you are looking for something else, and so on. So there are plenty of reasons to diverge. So for the fate of rats in labyrinth and our fate here to diverge. And that brings me, ladies and gentlemen, to another biographical confession. We are living in a world made of confessional. It is a confessional, huge confessional, contemporary world. We are all asked to confess. And what I want to confess in public, what I want to confess is what actually made me think about modernity and how it used to be and how did it change and where is it going and so on and so on. I already made one confession in the writing that I needed a shock to push me. I'm a heavy person, a slow thinker. I needed a shock to be pushed in this direction. It was a watershed in my own intellectual biography, and this shock was given by Janina by her book Winter in the Morning. But I think that there was also another shock, very close in time. Janina finished her book in 86, But there was before, just before that, there was 1984. And 1984, as you probably know, was the title of the, well, perhaps you don't know, there was a title of George Orwell book, 1984. And because it was the title of the book, then whoever had a pen and earned his living or her living by writing journalist articles wrote an article about George Orwell. And you know, we recognize eternity only when it is first sliced into episodes, into events. So it was an event, Orwellian event. For 2 days, everybody spoke about Orwell. After 2 days, no one spoke about Orwell again. It was all again forgotten, and so on and so on. All right. I shouldn't be astonished. If I am a sociologist, I should understand that that's exactly how information society works. But in case of Orwell, there was something special. Something special, mind you, because his book, 1984, for my generation anyway, served as the transcript of our inner feelings. Actually, all our fears, all our nightmares were expressed by Orwell in his vision of this terrifying society in which you are under constant observation, constantly watch. Big Brother watches you, and you are in constant fear of slightest transgression. You are sure that everything will be spotted, you will be immediately forced back into line, if not severely punished. That was the kind of nightmares our generation had. Totalitarianism, we were fresh from experience of two, at least, most awesome totalitarian forces of 20th century, for sure, but perhaps even the whole history. He just written down for us, in a sense, what we deeply felt, but were not able to articulate, to put in writing. When Orwell hype disappeared, vanished completely without trace in 2 days, I began to think, you know, it's too important a book to deserve such a fate. What has happened? What was the reason? My conclusion was that the contemporary generation, generation of readers in 1984, did not recognize their own fears in the book of Orwell. For them, it was historical piece, somewhere like Plinius the Elder, Historia Naturalis, very interesting piece, but its room is in the library on distant shelves, or Nostradamus prophecies, you know, but not actually their own story, not their own story. I don't mean that your fathers or grandfathers were more frightened than you are. Neither am I suggesting that you are more frightened than their grandfathers were. I think that every generation has its fears, apprehensions, uncertainties, nightmares. But they change over time. They change over time. And the nightmares of the contemporary generation are not nightmares of Orwell. They are not nightmares of the age of Orwell. What were the nightmares of the age of Orwell? Well, they were this push towards ordering brought to the extreme. And you could hear this sort of view, this sort of sentiment, that is the problem of our age, from every quarter, from enthusiast conservatives who actually were very pleased with the existing world, and with the critic, and from the critics, you know, the difference between optimists and pessimists. Optimists think that this is the best possible world, and the pessimists suspect that he might be right. So both sides were in complete agreement. You could read this sort of dark premonition in the very influential Sigmund Freud book, which was not necessarily aimed against the existing society, but which was full of the same fears. He said that, well, we are ceding more and more individual freedom for the sake of some solid, secure structures which are provided by our civilization. The critics of enlightenment, of contemporary civilization, like the founders of the critical school, Adorno and Horkheimer, were of the same opinion. Hannah Arendt wrote about endemic totalitarian tendency, which is in every contemporary society. The first reaction is more totalitarianism, more control, more structuring to every problem, first reaction to every problem. Then came Michel Foucault with his concept of panopticon as the paradigm of contemporary power. What is panopticon? It's a huge control tower, watching tower, with wings aside. And who is in the wings? Everybody who is submitted to the control of power, and that could be school children, university students, diseased people in hospitals, soldiers in the barracks, workers in the factory, whoever is a problem of control, of controlling, is put in one sort or another of panopticon-like structure, where they can be surveyed, where they are under observation. And even if they are not under observation at a particular moment, they can never be sure that their surveyors fell asleep, for example. They can't know, they have no way of knowing that they are not under observation. Therefore, they have to behave all their life in the same routine, subordinate way, following the rules, following the recipes, and so on and so on. So it was some sort of a general agreement about this point. And I think that what is the message which I brought here, I think that this particular period of modern history is by and large over, and it doesn't mean that we live in a world which is free of fears and apprehensions and threats. What it means is simply that if there are fears and apprehensions and threats, they are of different new kind, and the sooner we recognize that and the sooner we see it, I think the better we will be prepared to handle them and to deal with them. Now to start, for example, from the case which I already discussed briefly, namely the structure of power. For Michel Foucault, this panopticon structure was the common denominator of all kinds of social power, whatever is the field, the area in which it is exercised. Now, what's happened to this power? Power based on minute control, continuous control, observation, surveillance, immediate punishment whenever transgression is being spotted, and so on. That was the power which is a managing power. Managers actually putting people in their right places and seeing to it that they don't deviate, that they know that they do what they ought to be doing. I remember again as a student of sociology being taught one of the crucial concepts of sociology, which is socialization, the process undergone by every young member entering society. And I was a definition of socialization. I was required, like my colleagues, to memorize in order to pass my exams. What the socialization is, training people in willing to do what they do best. That was the definition of socialization at my time. So that had changed. The structure of power, it doesn't mean that power disappeared, it doesn't mean that domination disappeared, but it only means that the strategy of power, strategy of extricating obedience, discipline from society, has changed radically. It is not now by surveillance, not by insistent, obtrusive interference, management, and so on, but by the threat of being abandoned, by the threat of going away, which power is exercised and this discipline is elicited. If you don't behave in a particular way, well, all right, you stay here, I am going away, you are left alone, you are abandoned, and then you can count only on your own forces. You have a lot of sociological research showing that this is the case. French sociologist VTC Rosan Vallon pointed out on the basis of very, very extensive social research that managers are less and less interested in management. They don't want to manage. They don't want actually to tell their workers, their employees, their subordinates what to do. The burden of proof has shifted. It is not now up to managers to secure certain way of running, you know, the enterprise, the organization, whatever the organization is, but it's up to the employees to make themselves interesting to the managers, to the employers, to show them that they know they can do something interesting, they have initiative, they actually bring new ideas. Above all, they are flexible, adjustable, they don't stick to tradition, they are not, you know, very fond of anything in particular, so they can change their sympathy if necessary and go elsewhere and do something else and so on. So it is now the subordinates who have to seek their superiors rather than other way around. That's in the general tendency. Luc Bontanski and Eva Schiappello published a wonderful book. I don't recommend you for reading because it has over 1,000 pages, so I'm not a torturer, but it's very well argued and a very well researched book, which is called Le Nouvel Esprit de Capitalisme. And what they actually, among other things, what they inform us about is the criteria which they found to be a good recipe for success when you are applying for a job, you want to be accepted, appointed, and you are going through an interview for this purpose. So when you are lost, when you can be pretty sure that you won't be accepted and your interview ended in defeat, well, they listed a number of features which, if you have, better hide them, don't show them clearly. And there are features like being inadaptable, namely used to certain conditions and not liking change, not liking any other. Then being rigid, being immobile, namely being stuck. Well, I would live only in Trondheim. I would never move from there. You know, that's the only place where human beings can reside. That's the end of the story. That's the interview where interview ends. When you show that you are well rooted, well attached, that you have firm views. Now these are not recommended features for people who are after success in liquid modernity. What is the positive? What are the positive features according to Boltanski and Schiappello? Well, good connections, a lot of connections, which you can symbolize best if during the interview your mobile telephone rings several times. You know, so that means that you have connections. You are in a network, extended far, far away. Ability to communicate, namely to express yourself on the given topic when it comes. So you are not anymore restricted, constrained by the fact that you are not an expert on something. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that you have to be able to communicate, to convince people that you know what you are talking about. There must be a degree of self-confidence, which means that, in our individualized society, every one of us is expected to stand on his or her own feet and use his or her own resources in order to resolve his or her own problems. So self-assurance, self-confidence is quite necessary. But above all, the most important features stressed in the result of this very, very extensive research is feature of flexibility and mobility. Exterritoriality in a sense, exterritoriality not only in geographical sense, but in the sense of the social map, being able, willing, ready to move without much trauma from one kind of social setting to another social setting. Now, these are the features which constitute the thriving, successful contemporary elite, which is, as you very well know, there's no novelty, globalization is a widely discussed topic. The new elite is exterritorial. It's not tied to one place. Which brings me to the following hypothesis, mind you. Again, I'm terribly sorry, but Yadira put me in this mood, so I am in the reminiscing mood. Again, when I was a student, I was told the summary, in a sense, of mankind's history as a history of progress of humankind in such a way that first people were nomadic, they were hunting, going from place to place, and then settlers, some people settled, and the sedentary way of life slowly but surely proved its superiority over nomadic way of life, and finally the sedentary people triumphed, and they are just the pockets of nomads, like, you know, gypsies and so on. They remind us of this pre-modern, very, very primitive past, and therefore they should be expelled or hunted, you know, and anyway, go away from our sight. So history of progress, like history of passage from nomadic way of life to sedentary way of life. Sedentary people being progressive, nomadic being more primitive, barbaric. And the addendum to this concept was that you can think of civilization developing, civilized life developing only under sedentary settled conditions. When once people invented home place, now then civilization started to develop. My hypothesis is that we are witnessing a very strange reversal of this order, and the nomadic people have their vengeance over sedentary. The people who can actually be mobile, move at ease, who don't need anything more than just no heavy luggage, they don't need anything more but mobile telephone, portable computer, a briefcase, and eventually toothbrush, but not necessarily so. Now, these people have advantage over those people who, for one reason or another, are either stuck to the locality or kept by force in this locality, not allowed to move. There are such people, you know. The current rate now for smuggling a foreign worker through Mexican-American border into America is $30,000. You people who are not kept perforce to the ground, you can for this sort of money, you know, travel all around the world actually and be welcomed in most distinguished hotels, Holiday Inns or whatever, or even Radisson's. For those who are not allowed to move on their own will, that is the price. And I think that market is a very sensitive instrument to availability or not availability of certain goods. And this high price, $30,000, testifies to the rarity of the goods which are sold in this way. Nomads are again in the saddle, I think. One of the reasons why the nation state, the most powerful institution which modernity invented in its up and coming stage, in its solid stage, the institution of collective action, of effective collective action, one of the reasons why nation state is losing a lot of its power and is and cannot be actually the master in its own house anymore, it has to listen and very carefully to what the invisible, fast moving, not easily detectable global forces actually require. One of the reasons is that these global forces are precisely mobile, nomadic, while the political power stays local as before. It is sedentary. It is sedentary. That's why it suffers. That's why it cannot face the new threat on equal footing. On equal footing. Well, just before the Second World War, there was a book which made tremendous impact. It was very widely discussed and aroused a real sensation. It was written by James Burnham. It was called The Managerial Revolution. James Burnham reversed the opinion which was widely accepted of Marx, that power resides in ownership. You know, who owns means of production has the power. And he showed up that means of production are not the ownership of means of production is no more the basis of real power, if it ever was. Marx and Engels in the third volume of The Capital used the parable, the allegory of symphonic orchestra to prove that capitalism is unnecessary. What he said there was that conductor of a symphonic orchestra doesn't have to be the owner of the means of playing, of the instrument, of the musical instrument. And he was absolutely right. What he, didn't notice was that very few conductors ever wished to buy musical instruments of the symphonic orchestra, but very many owners of instruments and music halls and so on didn't want to conduct. It was too much a chore for them, so they hired conductors to do the job for them. And managing is a very tiresome activity. And people who can avoid it would do it very gladly. Now comes James Burnham and says, look, stealthily, surreptitiously, without anyone noticing it, the managers, which began as hired people, stole the power. And the real power shifted from just a passive ownership to active management of people. Whoever manages the people has power. Well, it seems that what's happened to the owners who wanted to get rid of the managing, tiresome, very complex function and hired managers to do it for them, now what's happened to them is happening now to management. To management. Management doesn't want to manage. Management much prefer people, individuals, being threatened by this abandonment, by running away, by this Houdini act of vanishing, you know. They should manage themselves. They should try to squeeze out of themselves as much subordination, discipline, usefulness as possible, and prove to the management that they are exactly like that. There's very interesting research of the changing managerial, difficult to say, ideology, managerial consciousness, at least in England and America. I'm not sure whether it applies also to this country. One very interesting study is by Nigel Thrift, and what does it show? First of all, the changing language which is used by the managers. They are not speaking anymore about plan, structure, and so on. There are no diagrams on their walls. They are fond of speaking about dancing, surfing. You know, that is these are the metaphors which show the good managerial strategy, being able to smoothly, quickly, as fast as possible, move to another position, grasp another opportunity. look around for that opportunity and be there in time when it appears. They don't speak in terms of stable factory crews, staff and things like that, but rather in terms of teams, coalitions, connections, networks, and so on. Again, something underlining mobility, flexibility. In 1930s, Henry Ford, who was as important to businessmen of that era as Bill Gates is important to businessmen of our era, and now this Henry Ford astonished the world by doubling the wages of his workers overnight, doubling. He was pressed by the by newspaper men. Why did you do it? It is so opposite to the ordinary practice. And he, of course, tongue in cheek, he said, "I wanted my workers to buy my cars," which was of course a joke, really, because the amount of cars which his workers could buy was negligible. But doubling the expenses or the workforce increased the costs of production quite considerably. So why he did it? And the real reason was he wanted simply to keep his workers, because the workers were dependent on Ford for their livelihood. Okay, but Ford was as much dependent on them for his wealth and his profits. He couldn't do without them. All his power was in his possessions, in the factory, in the walls, in the machinery, in the raw materials, in the means of transportation, in the shops selling his cars, and so on and so on. He had to keep his possessions in order to keep his power. The employees, I think, are as dependent on their employers as they used to be, but the employers are no more, to the same extent, dependent on their employees. So that is hence the new strategy of power, consisting mostly in the swiftness with which you can change position, move away, close one factory, open one factory several thousand miles away from the place, you know, close down, merge with another firm, and then cut the assets, you know, liquidize the assets in order to get immediate profit and things like that. But it's one aspect of liquid modernity. There are many of them, and you probably don't expect me to go through all of them in our liquid kind of society. I don't believe that any one of you would agree to suffer such a long discussion. But some of the aspects of new kind of experience which we have in liquid society, I feel obliged to mention. I would like to bring to your attention two gaps which are emerging, which in contemporary society, and to which I think are the most vulnerable, most neurotic parts of contemporary social reality, in which one could suspect major departures, major changes, and major effort to restructure, remake, improve on social reality in the coming century will be accomplished. One is the process of individualization, which is an integral aspect of the liquidization of modernity. Individualization, which means that people are individuals, by decree at least, by decree. By decree in the sense that if you have a problem, and everyone has a problem, then you should accept that it is your individual problem which you have to cope with individually using your individual resources, resources which stand at your disposal. That one thing, being individual, which I am inclined to call de jure, as distinct from individual de facto. Now, this being individual de jure is not a matter of choice. In our society of choosers, free choosers, this one thing is beyond choice. You can't avoid being a chooser. That's not up for choosing. Individual de jure, in other words, being individual de jure, in other words, is a fate. A fate of all of us. So, if you fail, if you don't succeed, you have only yourself to blame. You must find explanation for it in terms of your laziness, your ignorance, your lack of determination, your inaptitude to find the right solution to a problem and whatever. But the gap which I mentioned, the first of the gaps which I mentioned, exists between individuality de jure and individuality de facto. To be individual de facto means more than just being abandoned to individual risky choices. All of you know probably Ulrich Beck, Risikogesellschaft. He points out that our society is endemically full of risk. And living in Risikogesellschaft is Risikoleben. It's life full of risks. So that is the meaning of being individual de jure, but individual de facto means to be able to deploy your freedom of choice to actually get to see through your own choice, to select the kind of life, the kind of style of life, the kind of model of life which you really wish to conduct, which is really to your liking, and actually make it stick, secure, make it secure, make it there, be there. Now, between individuality de jure and individuality de facto, there is a long, long distance, which is not filled, not bridged so far for great majority of people. Great majority, not all of them, mind you. People who actually are very resourceful, who have a lot of resources and so on, they can swim very easily and with a good deal of pleasure. This dancing and serving is a very pleasurable pastime, providing you have access to a good beach, you know, and you can surf there, you have good implements and a lot of time to practice the skills and things like that. But for a great majority of people, it is a very uphill struggle. It's an uphill struggle. It's a very tall order, actually, to translate this individuality by decree into factual individuality. I am my own life chooser. For two different reasons. For one reason is the very unequal distribution of resources in contemporary society, and a very shifting one, non-reliable one. The accumulation of resources became a very risky business, much more risky than it used to be. But in general, there is this process of polarization, of inequity in distribution of resources. And the second reason is actually a very banal one, namely that once put in a position of individuals de jure, we are all participating in self-propelling, self-reinforcement, self-deepening of this sort of a situation. As W. I. Thomas, a great American sociologist, wants to say, when people define certain situation as real, it tends to become real in consequence of their action. So when you watch chat shows on television and you see one after another individual admitting that he had individual problem which he fought individually using his own individual resources, then you switch off the television screen, reinforced, reassured, and that is how life is, and there is no retreat from that. Pierre Bourdieu, American, French sociologist, gave a name to this new ideology of our age, as he calls it, and the name is TINA. That's abbreviation. T-I-N-A, there is no alternative. TINA. And if everybody says TINA, then that is the end of the story. So it's another vicious circle, which requires a special discussion how to cut it. Vicious circles, like Gordian knots, cannot be untied, they can all be cut. So it has to be cut somewhere, but how, it's a different matter. But let me go to the first problem, this rising inequity in distribution of resources. And that leads me to the second gap, this issue of inequity of resources, second gap. The second gap is already I briefly mentioned what consists of the one-sidedness of the globalization process. It is one-sided process because what has been globalized are the economics, the economic forces, the capital, the trade, the commodities, the circulation of commodities, and so on. They have been globalized. But the means of collective action which have been developed, following the example of the ancient Greece, during the modern history, namely the democratic institutions of nation-states, they remain, as before, local. And therefore, the real factors decisive about human condition are beyond their reach. This is the second gap. It's not the first time when this gap has appeared in modern history. Max Weber, one of the founders of social sciences, defined the beginning of modern capitalism, of modern society in general, actually, as separation of business from the household. Separation of business from household. By household, of course, he meant something more than just your own house. Not very many people had their own houses anyway. Household stood for everything which was surrounding you. Your community, your parish, the craftsmen guild to which you belonged, the village of which you were part as a peasant or a farmer. Now, all these near institutions which were surrounding you at very close quarters all the time, they were the foundations of rules which you had to obey. They were the controlling institutions. They were the source of ethical principles, of your obligations, of your duties, of the patterns of interaction, mutual help, and so on and so on. There was no other foundation for all that. Only the household and its surroundings, right? Now, when business got freedom from this household, it got freedom also from all these restraints, all these constraints. The traditional duties, you know, orthodox obligations, ethical principles, whatever. It operated in an empty territory where it could create its own rules from scratch. No one was breathing at its neck. That was the great separation which brought about at the initial period of industrialization, building of contemporary society, as you know, brought about tremendous devastation, a lot of poverty, a lot of human misery, a lot of human uprooting, a lot of human disembedding, and things like that. Until the nation state stepped into this hole, into this void, and tried with mixed success to replace the local community, which was extinct, you know, local community in these basic functions of taking care, providing collective insurance against individual mishaps, promoting and controlling execution of certain ethical principles, and so on, and so on, and so on. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we are facing separation mark two. This time, business separates again, but not from local community. It did it 200 years ago. but it separates now from the Asian state, the only effective means of controlling, regulating, imposing restrictions and whatever. There is nothing above the level of nation state which can do it, and because of that, this emancipated business is again operating in a certain legal, ethical and political void where everything is possible, everything is for grabs. That is the freedom, the new freedom of global business, that no existing means of collective action are powerful enough to outweigh the power arising out of the unattachedness of the global business. As you know, ladies and gentlemen, there are two conferences going on at the moment, one in Davos, the other in Puerto Alegre in South Brazil. The first one is about how to make globalization a success, how to make the world free and secure for circulation of commodities, finances, and so on and so on. The other one, in the counter meeting in Puerto Alegre, is not anti-globalization. That's a misunderstanding, if you think that it's anti-globalization. I think the other meeting there is how to make globalization more even-handed. Not just economics globalizing, but also the political control, the values, the ethics globalizing as well, on a par with what's going on in the field of economics, so that they can do what, with mixed success, I repeat, but nevertheless attempted to do nation-state, trying, you know, to balance the emancipated economic power by promoting certain rules which have to be obeyed, guaranteed by the monopoly of coercion which the state possessed. So that's the second gap which stays unfilled. We are, I think, ladies and gentlemen, that's my hypothesis, that we are facing a departure, a change as profound, as radical, as the one which our part of the world at least went through at the very beginning of modernity, with the passage from ancien régime to the modern kind of state power. It's as profound a challenge, and it had to be faced in as serious a way as the old one. The urgency of the matter is beyond reasonable doubt. I mentioned to you that the period of relative freedom of business emancipated from household resulted in a lot of human poverty, uprootedness, misery, and so on. And so does the separation Mark II, only on a global scale. It is no more the question inside society, polarization inside society, but polarization in the global scale, in the world scale. Foci of misery, of permanent famine, hunger, destruction of means, traditional means of eking out existence, which are spreading very unevenly around the world. And clearly, some sort of larger, bigger scale equivalent of agency of collective action, which was invented in 19th century, 20th century, in the form of the nation state, providing welfare state and so on, something like that is imperative. And because I am neither optimist nor pessimist, according to the definition which I gave you, neither I believe that this is the best possible world, nor do I believe that that might be a grain of truth in saying so. I believe that just as much as human ingenuity, inventiveness found solution to the problems posited by the gaps which were yawning 200 years ago, so sooner or later we will find solution to the present problems as well. But it's going to be a long process and a very painful one. and very tortuous, full of trials and errors. I believe, ladies and gentlemen, not me, I am too old for that, unfortunately, fortunately, I'm not sure, but you, who are much younger, will probably find out that filling these two gaps will be the major concern, the major problem of the century which is starting just now. But,
thank you for the stimulating talk, and now we have the chance to ask questions to Simon Baumann. I don't know who wants to start.
Lecture covered a vast territory, a vast field. Your books, in total at least, cover even more. So if one feels that something was lacking in your lecture, one might profitably go to your books to find answers there. But what I'm going to say is then addressed to your lecture as such, to what we have been hearing here today. The first point has to do with your presentation of Marx. Because the way you put it today, Marx comes out very much as a sort of child of classic modernity, and his way of doing social analysis is very much symptomatic or characteristic of modernity. In many ways, that is certainly the case. However, when you move to some of your descriptions of present-day globalized capitalism, the words you use to describe liquidized modernity and the present trends, these words are, to a great extent, the words we find in Marx. You talk about the thirst for immediate profit. And there seems to be no need to introduce sort of new categories beyond that one. You're still using that Marxian one. No, of course, you may say that Marx was wrong, or he was selective in focusing so much on ownership of means of production. And in many ways, his analysis in Capital were, of course, tied to capitalism in its industrialized era, the factory as the paradigm of control, and so on. But I think that still in your book on globalization from 98, which has been translated into Norwegian, globaliseringen og dens menneskelige konsekvenser, eller snarere umenneskelige, you also point out, as do a lot of sociological authors on globalization these days, that this regime of strict order, surveillance, regularity, this regime is still very much in force today. Only it is not localized in our countries like Britain or Norway or North America. It has been moved physically to the so-called third world, where this whole regime, as described by Marx, is very much what is still sort of shaping the conditions under which this workforce is put to work there. So I'm talking about the actual work being done for multinationals such as Nike or Benetton. And that is of course part of your own analysis, we don't get to see that from where we live anymore. But it's still very much part of the way capitalism, to the extent that it still involves production of commodities, production of products also for some kind of use value, is being put in order, is being regulated by the owners. So that was one thing. Another thing that just a second one before I finish. Where one might question the continued relevance of Marx has to do with the economy. Now, economy is a lot of things, but I'm thinking about the terminology of economics. The terminology which has it that what counts is profit. What counts is the chances that profit will increase. Now, there are all kinds of structural changes, as you point out yourself. The profit now is geared towards what is profitable for the stockholders. That's the first part of your globalization book. But what I'm thinking about is that this terminology or language of economics is being expanded, is being introduced in practically all areas of public and professional life. So this means that areas in society which until relatively recently were organized according to other tasks, other demands than those who can be understood within the language of economics, these areas are today subjected to that very terminology, to these very criteria, and to the goals characteristic of economics, such as profitability. I'm talking about the great public institutions of classic social democracy. Public services, health, public transportation, the media, radio, television, and so on. These are now all being subjected to the same set of goals. And I would like you to reflect somewhat on that, whether it does not show that there is very much still a priority that must be given in social analysis to so-called base. Okay.
Well, it's very difficult to hide before Arne Johan Vetlesen. His spot is always on the right spot, and I even think that order is reversed sometimes. I think so, that the spots jump out whenever he points his finger. So he's absolutely right in saying that my interpretation of Marx is a little bit idiosyncratic, even perhaps a lot of idiosyncrasy is there. I do believe, I repeat once again, I agree, to start with, I agree that there could be many, and there will be many interpretations of Marx, because he, like every great thinker, he is very ambivalent, ambiguous, there are many strands intertwining in his work. But he was a modernist par excellence, modernist par excellence. His quarrel with capitalism was not a quarrel about the possibility of creating a well-organized society by design, by an effort, by planning, and so on and so on. What his quarrel was about with capitalism was that capitalism does this job not as efficiently as it should, and that there are very powerful ethical reservations about the price social price which is to be paid for executing this design. So, in other words, go away, capitalists, we will do it better. We will do it better by socializing means of production, restoring them to their intrinsically social nature already with this, in this era of tremendous development of technology. Arne Johan is absolutely right when he says that Marx used very similar terms in criticizing capitalism, getting out of control, let loose, running amok, you know, and making creating devastation in this way. Very much in identical terms, I speak about this globalized capitalism of separation of Mark II. But that is precisely the difference. Mind you, one of the least flattering aspects of Marx is that the only reference in his works to the what you call third world, the faraway places, the exotic places, was this, I don't know where from he got this expression, Kazakh-Kyrgyz. So whenever he reasoned about situation in England, in other cases of Europe, there was a side remark very often, but of course it is different with Kazakh-Kyrgyz. Kazakh-Kyrgyz stood for the compound third world. It was not a problem then at the same scale which we are facing. Only Lenin actually introduced this globalization aspect into Marxism by writing this book about imperialism, you know, capitalism becoming a global force. Marx and Engels thought and discussed and criticized capitalism in its then framework, which is the framework of the nation state. Polarization, when Marx spoke of polarization, was polarization between the workers of the same country and the capitalists of the same country. Pauperization, again, was confined in this, and it was quite rightly so, because that was really the issue on the agenda at that time. So it is not a secondary factor that we now have to switch from discussing these matters in one state, one nation, one territory terms to the discussing it in global terms. Simply because when Marx wrote, particularly in the later part of his life, there were already certain institutions of social power in place which could, at least in principle, do the job. And what I'm saying is that the second separation is not so advanced yet. Second separation is in a stage in which the instruments which could actually do something about the condition are not very well visible. They are yet to be invented. They are yet to be put in place. And that's a different situation. The first inklings of the new tendency of contemporary capital I got from one, I don't remember in which year it was, but it was under Margaret Thatcher, one of the annual Tory conservative conferences. I remember businessmen, powerful businessmen, rising to speak one after another and pushing through the idea. Well, we understand, we should pay local taxes because we need public good streets, we need a sewage system, we need water, otherwise we can't produce anything. But why should we pay for the unemployed, why should we pay for the invalids, why should we pay for social misery? We don't get any profit from them. Now, in 19th century, capitalists spoke entirely different tongue, you know. That was reserve army of labor, which had to be kept in good state, in good condition of health, you know, the ability to serve, just in case they would be called back. So this new indifference, new equanimity, new irresponsibility, this non-attachment to the ground, not feeling responsible for the consequences, after all, of their own action, because misery and pauperization, things like that, are consequences of their action. Now, that was sign of the new approaching times. And I think that we are still far behind in imagining ways in which we could deal with this challenge. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for an excellent lecture. I'd just like to touch upon your point of business being separate now from the nation state. But isn't it so that the businesses in some way still are using the nation state in the north or conglomerates of nation states to preserve the markets of the west or the north for themselves and barring imports, that is a kind of protectionism that is not allowed to the other side, to the south?
Yeah, of course.
And secondly, I'd like to comment on your concluding optimism at the end of your lecture, because when you say that there will be regulations found, we will be able to invent some kind of transnational rules to deal with modern business. But the difference between when the nation-state was created after the death of l'ancien régime and today, isn't that when the nation-state was created, it served the businesses, whilst today, if one wants to create rules which would really regulate, let's say, to the benefit of people, the businesses, that would not be in their correspondence to their interests, like, for example, the very modest proposition of the Tobin taxation. Thank you.
Yes, you are absolutely right in the point you made. Of course, that's the aspect precisely of the polarization I was speaking about, that globalization brings utterly unequal results, effects for different parts of the globe. We are priding ourselves about globalization of investment, globalization of trade, but what the world markets and world investment actually mean is that 70 to 80% of investment and trade goes into already affluent countries, and the rest of the world is left without, only with rising debts. That's true. That's the fact, and that's actually not the opposite of the problem, but it is actually the problem I was talking about. Exactly similar phenomena were happening in 19th century. They were measured, they were conceived, they were embraced by a much narrower horizon. The separations, the exclusions, the polarizations happening within one country under one sovereign rule. Society and nation-state were identical notions. Whenever sociologists spoke about society, what they had in mind was the territory enclosed by the sovereign power of nation-state. Now, however, it happens on the global scale. And in the absence of the equally global political, cultural, and ethical institutions and whatever. Now about conglomerations of the state, well, states. Now that's really also a very difficult issue. I am breaking my head trying to answer, to take my stand towards European Union, for example. It's a conglomeration of states, and it has, I think it is endemically ambivalent issue, which has two different strands, which are very difficult to reconcile. One, European Union serves as a laboratory, a very important laboratory, a very necessary laboratory, in which we experiment with and we learn to live with rules, regulations, which are made above the level of the nation state, in a supranation state territory, which we have sooner or later filled with some sort of institution. So perhaps that's kind of laboratory which may bring us one little step forward toward this purpose. I don't know. The time will show. But there is another aspect as well, namely the aspect of the besieged fortress. My country, Poland, is knocking to the door of European Union, wants to be accepted. And the major condition which was put to Poland, among all other conditions, but the one in which European Union insists most, is that they have to close and fortify their eastern borders. Act as a collective policeman for Europe, not to let in these wild people, you know, from Ukraine, Belarusia, Caucasus, and so on, which Poles, by the way, don't like particularly because they were dreaming about Poland being a bridge rather than a wall, bridge between West and East. But obviously, the other tendency in European Union does point in this direction. So it is a mixed phenomenon. I'm not able, really, to take a simple eindeutig, as the Germans would say, stand on this issue. I think there are two tendencies, and I wonder whether you can have, how you put it, conglomeration of states without these two tendencies being co-present at the same time.
My name is Paul Erold. I work at this college. As you can understand from the question, I'm a pedagogue. I was wondering, you didn't use so much the term complexity. We can agree that the society evolves with a faster speed, I think everyone agrees, but yeah. I've been doing some thinking when talking with students. Is today's society really more complex? And how should we measure complexity, from the point of view of the perception of the person or from the empirical conditions surrounding us?
I don't need it, thank you. Perhaps it was my mistake, rightly or wrongly, I'm not sure. Perhaps you are right, I'm not. I think that we are at the stage, or perhaps that's our future, it's very difficult to say, at the stage in which the important issue is not so much complexity as falling apart of complex systems, disentangling of certain coordinated, very well articulated elements of the system, letting some of them separate from the rest, giving them relative autonomy. So if it is a complex society, there's no question about it, but the shape of complexity is changing, and the structure, the composition of complexity is changing. I'm terribly sorry, I'm beginning to reminisce again, but when I was a student, you know, I like remembering when I was young, I was taught sociology by Talcott Parsons, and we also learned about complex system. Society is a complex system, but in this complex, everything was smoothly coordinated, you know, they worked together, so it was some sort of a self-equilibrating system. It was thrown out of gear, it had the power of returning to the previous state. It was guarding its integrity. So I think when we speak about system, about society, what we need to underline today is not so much complexity, but precisely the falling apart, you know, the disentangling, the disintegrating, disequilibrating. What is the most fascinating and fascinating for sociologists, challenging for all of us, and threatening also, I'm afraid, for all of us, is not so much complexity of contemporary society, but precisely it's what I'm saying, well, fluidity, keeping shape. That's what actually is happening. So I would rather dwell on this other aspect than on what is the permanent feature of any society, which means that it's complex phenomenon.
I think when we're talking about separating business from national state and globalization mainly as trade, there's one level we have to pay more attention to, and it's the regionalization, the new institution coming up. OECD, WTO, EU, NAFTA, APEC, yeah. All this new regulation and the new institutionalization going on. So in many ways, it's not true that we have a real globalization, but we have a regional globalization in many ways. Yeah. That's one point. Another one, but maybe it's not time. With your background, living in Britain, we have followed the debate connected to Thatcher regime and ideology later to Blair and Giddens. And I would like very much to hear your comment to Giddens, last try to find the third way. What do you mean by the third way? It's too good to go the third way. In many ways, to bridge the gap between business and get a kind of new government.
I don't think it's third way. Personally, I'm not very fond of it. You know, I think that there are two problems which are to be faced, one and the other, and we are doomed probably to find out always some sort of striking a compromise between the two, surrendering one value, a bit of one value in order to get something of the other value. It is something suspicious when people start thinking about third way, because third weighing is what we all do constantly in our societies and in our individual lives. We have, for instance, the most important instance of them all, I think. There are two values without which human life is impossible. One is security, the other is freedom. You can't be happy without freedom, you can't be happy without security. But we can't have both at the same time. The more freedom you have, the less security you have, the more security you have, the less freedom you have. So it is always a pendulum, a striking some sort of a balance. And when one comes and speaks, I have a third way between freedom and security, that means that there is some, you know, attempt to deceive somebody's vigilance. So I'm not very fond of that. But about these new institutions, which you mentioned, really, since you mentioned Anthony Giddens, my dear friend, Anthony Giddens, I must underline to prevent any source of misunderstanding, Anthony Giddens also coined the term disembedding about the nature of modern life. It is disembedding people, taking them out of the beds in which they were born and out into the wide world and asking them to find their own place, very much like the Chancellor of Exchequer in England said that the pound won't be any more protected by the government, it will to have its own place. So disembedding is like that. Go into the world, find your own place. All right. But my point, which I try to make today here, is that in the stage of solid modernity, disembedding was done in order of re-embedding. Finding better beds, more solid, more, you know, well-made, better designed, orthopedic or whatever, you know. So now however, today we have a situation where disembedding goes on daily, but without much of re-embedding. The only beds available for re-embedding are motel beds or sleeping bags, you know, so they don't promise a stable condition. You mentioned all these new institutions emerging. That's true, but as many new institutions are emerging, as many are disappearing. Mind you go through British city streets and you see as a big advertisement for a company which sells something there, the firm exists since 1993, you see. 7 years is already a sign of distinction. We survived 7 years. We are here in the same place, in the same street, in the same shop. So the term is shortening very, very, very quickly. And that creates this impression, this experience of disembedding without hope for secure re-embedding.
Okay, before we finish, I would like Janina to come up here. Yes? And while she's coming up, I would also inform you that in the 22nd of November, Sigmund Baumann will be part of the Fourth Nordic Symposium on Social Work Research here at this place. But you'll hear about that later.
If he lives that long.
Yes. And if he lives...
Some companies live since 1993.
Yeah, okay. But we are trying to contribute to that. You see that here at the University College, we have a special type of flowers for nomadic people like you. Uh-huh. Flowers you can bring with you on the plane more easily than those who die. So because of that, we will just symbolically give you a bottle of wine.
I like very much this kind of flowers.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Sventura.
Yeah.